Picture this, if you will. You're a physician working at a student health clinic, and you see a 22-year-old college pre-medical student who reports several weeks of anxiety. Definitely not the first time I've seen that before, you think to yourself, remembering your own days as a pre-med. She describes how her symptoms were making it hard for her to keep up with her course load, and that she's even considering withdrawing from the semester completely. You go through a review of systems and are surprised to hear a far more comprehensive and specific list of complaints than most of your anxious college students. She's been experiencing excessive sweating, palpitations, nausea, and diarrhea, and she tells you that she missed her last menstrual period. You check her chart, and while her vital signs are normal, you notice that since she was last seen 1 year ago, she's lost 20 pounds. Concerned, you ask about recent changes in her diet, exercise, and drug use. "No, and I'm definitely not on a diet," she exclaims. "If anything, I feel like I'm always eating these days. I'm never full for more than a few hours after eating." What potential diagnoses do you consider in this patient? And what tests are most important in this patient's initial workup? And welcome to AudioBricks. I'm Arjun Iyer, bringing topics from endocrinology from our bricks to your ears. After this episode, you'll be able to 1. Define hyperthyroidism and its prevalence. 2. Describe and explain the typical symptoms of hyperthyroidism. 3. Explain the common causes of hyperthyroidism and define thyroid storm. 4. Describe the physical exam findings and laboratory diagnosis of hyperthyroidism. And 5. Outline the treatment of hyperthyroidism, including the risks of therapy. Part 1. What is hyperthyroidism? Hyperthyroidism is, obviously, the condition in which a patient has high levels of circulating thyroid hormone. It's less common than hypothyroidism and affects around 1% of the population in iodine-sufficient areas of the world. Of note, it's significantly more common in women who have a lifetime risk of 3%, compared to 0.5% for men. Hyperthyroidism is most often primary, meaning due to a problem with the thyroid gland itself. It can also be secondary, meaning that the excess thyroid hormone secretion is caused by stimulation by excess TSH from the pituitary. Finally, it can be caused by exogenous ingestion of thyroid hormone. Furthermore, each condition may also have some individual effects specific to that disease. Part 2. How does a patient with hyperthyroidism present? No matter the cause, the clinical effects of hyperthyroidism are mostly pretty predictable. If you know that the normal function of the thyroid hormone is increasing basal metabolism and potentiating the sympathetic nervous system. Elevating basal metabolic rate causes a fairly specific combination of weight loss and increased food intake, which is often not found in other conditions that cause hyperactivity of the sympathetic nervous system. Furthermore, since increasing the basal metabolic rate causes cells to generate more heat, patients with hyperthyroidism are often heat intolerant and sweat more than usual to compensate for the thermogenesis with evaporative cooling. Patients usually have increased GI motility to keep up with the greater metabolic need, so patients often experience not only increased appetite, but also diarrhea. Additionally, many symptoms result from thyroid hormone's ability to upregulate the beta-1 adrenergic receptors. What this means is that for every microgram of epinephrine in the bloodstream, cardiac myocytes respond more strongly by increasing heart rate and contractility. And this can actually be pretty dangerous in excess, as it can manifest as tachycardia, palpitations, or even arrhythmias ranging from atrial fibrillation, which is the most common, to ventricular arrhythmias in very severe cases. And in patients with underlying coronary artery disease, increased beta-1 activity causes increased myocardial oxygen demand that can manifest as a greater predisposition to anginal chest pain. The combination of effects of excess thyroid hormone often lead to psychomotor agitation, tremors, hyperreflexia, and restlessness. It can even contribute to a range of psychiatric disorders, including insomnia, anxiety disorders, and even psychosis. One less intuitive but fairly common manifestation of hyperthyroidism is disruption of the menstrual cycle, and either oligomenorrhea or amenorrhea may occur. Estrogen and progesterone, as steroid hormones, are transported through the aqueous blood by reversible binding to sex hormone binding globulin. High levels of thyroid hormone lead to increased levels of sex hormone binding globulin, effectively sequestering more of the free sex hormones and leaving less unbound hormone in the blood to interact with cells in the body. And since testosterone is transported in much the same way, both men and women can have decreased libido and fertility. Finally, patients with hyperthyroidism often have various musculoskeletal and connective tissue abnormalities. Some of these include muscle weakness and onycholysis, which is when the fingernails fall off. All right, let's check in real quick. What are the two alterations in normal physiology responsible for the majority of clinical findings in hyperthyroidism? The answer is increased basal metabolism and potentiation of the sympathetic nervous system. Part 3. What causes hyperthyroidism? Since secondary hyperthyroidism from pituitary overproduction of TSH is much less common, today we're going to focus on primary hyperthyroidism. For more on secondary hyperthyroidism, check out the brick on hyperpituitarism, since increased TSH production is often accompanied by increased secretion of other trophic hormones. But switching back to primary hyperthyroidism, the most common etiology in the United States is Graves' disease. It's an autoimmune disorder in which TSH receptor-stimulating antibodies bind to the TSH receptors on the thyroid follicular cells, causing the thyroid to overproduce thyroid hormones. It can be identified by a smooth goiter, and unique findings like exophthalmos, where the eyes bulge out of the head, and pretibial myxedema, a form of non-pitting edema in the shins. The funny thing is, myxedema is also a feature of hypothyroidism, but when it's associated with hyperthyroidism, it means it's being caused by Graves' disease. Other common causes of hyperthyroidism include toxic multinodular goiter, which is the second most common, and toxic thyroid adenomas. In both cases, a focal area or areas of hyperplasia develops in the thyroid and overproduces thyroid hormone. The nodularity on physical exam and focal areas of increased uptake on radioactive iodine uptake scanning clinch the diagnosis. For an adenoma, surgical removal cures the problem, but for a multinodular goiter, you have to either remove the whole gland or destroy it through radioactive ablation. Next, we have a couple of forms of hyperthyroidism that can be transient. Thyroiditis, or inflammation of the thyroid gland, can cause hyperthyroidism, especially early in the disease course. What happens is, the inflamed thyroid gland will leak preformed thyroid hormone from its reservoirs in the thyroid follicles into the bloodstream. Subacute granulomatous thyroiditis, also known as de Crevin's thyroiditis, most commonly does this and can be identified by a diffusely tender goiter, and the fact that it usually follows a viral infection. Hashimoto thyroiditis can also present with hyperthyroidism, and you may hear this early stage colloquially referred to as hashitoxicosis. Ultimately, and especially with Hashimoto's thyroiditis, the inflammation will destroy thyroid cells and prevent sufficient synthesis of thyroid hormone, which eventually leads the patient to hypothyroidism. Hyperthyroidism is remarkably common in pregnancy as well due to a number of factors, and this might explain in part why hyperthyroidism is more common in women. These factors include stimulation of the TSH receptor by human chorionic gonadotropin, or HCG, estrogen-induced rise in thyroxine-binding globulin, and alterations in the immune system which may unmask underlying autoimmune thyroid disease. The first two causes usually resolve when the pregnancy ends, but autoimmune damage to the thyroid gland may not. And finally, while it's not really a cause of primary hyperthyroidism, overingestion of thyroid hormone, or exogenous hyperthyroidism, is worth mentioning because it has the same clinical presentation and is pretty common. It's just that the extra thyroid hormone comes not from the gland, but from ingested drugs. Thyroid hormones are used widely, both for the treatment of hypothyroidism and, over-the-counter, for weight loss. The problem is, over-the-counter products are often poorly regulated and can contain varying amounts of the hormones since they're not FDA-regulated. And you can turn a euthyroid patient who maybe just needs to exercise a little bit more into a functionally hyperthyroid patient. There's no goiter in this case because the thyroid itself is actually repressed by high exogenous thyroid levels that also, by the way, suppress the TSH. Got all that? Okay, time for a quick knowledge check. What are the two most common causes of primary hyperthyroidism in the United States? Graves' disease and toxic multinodular goiter are the two most common causes of primary hyperthyroidism. Now on to the dark side of hyperthyroidism, where we'll see some of the more dramatic presentations. You see, thyroid disease exists on a spectrum. A surprising number of patients have subclinical hyperthyroidism, in which there's measurable thyroid dysfunction, but the patient is either asymptomatic or basically doesn't complain of anything serious enough to go to the doctor for. Hell, they may even like the fact that they're losing weight even though they didn't change their eating habits. Patients with symptomatic disease are said to have thyrotoxicosis, and these are the patients whose insomnia, palpitations, chronic diarrhea, etc. actually cause them to seek medical attention. The most severe manifestation of thyrotoxicosis is called thyroid storm, or a thyrotoxic crisis. There's no clear defining line between severe thyrotoxicosis and thyroid storm, but most people would make the diagnosis when the physiologic changes of thyrotoxicosis become life-threatening. Effects on the central nervous system, like acute agitated delirium, seizures, and coma, become a lot more pronounced, and heat intolerance becomes hyperthermia. Serious cardiovascular symptoms, such as high-output heart failure and tachyarrhythmias, are very common causes of death in this patient population. Finally, marked liver damage and even liver failure can result in this patient population from a combination of hyperthermia and congestive hepatopathy from heart failure. Thyroid storm usually occurs when existing hyperthyroidism meets an acute physiologic stressor, like infection, trauma, or surgery, that can trigger a massive overproduction of thyroid hormones. It can also occur after abrupt withdrawal of antithyroid drugs that are usually used to treat these conditions. Remember that in any of the above causes of hyperthyroidism, you need to be aware that thyroid storm is a potential complication. Part 4. How do we diagnose hyperthyroidism? The diagnostic workup for hyperthyroidism begins with identifying the characteristic signs and symptoms that prompt a series of serum studies and radiologic tests. The most common vitals abnormalities are tachycardia and hypertension, most commonly driven by an elevation in the systolic blood pressure. Now, when it comes to the physical exam, I know everyone's going to want to grab the patient's neck the moment they suspect hyperthyroidism, but it's important to remember that the thyroid exam will vary depending on the cause of hyperthyroidism. For example, Graves' disease patients usually have an enlarged, smooth, non-tender goiter. It may be lumpy in a multinodular goiter, or even have a single enlarged nodule on a thyrotoxic adenoma. You may not even feel any abnormality at all if the patient's obese, has a big neck, or if your fingers just aren't that sensitive. So you definitely should palpate the thyroid, but take what you find with a grain of salt. On the eye exam, look for lid lag and stare. Both are signs of too much thyroxine. You do this by having the patient follow the examiner's finger to look up and down. The patient is said to have lid lag if the sclera is visible above the iris as the patient looks down. Normally, the eyelid lowers smoothly as the gaze tracks downward, but in hyperthyroidism, the eyelid often lags behind the orbital muscles. Now, this is not the same as exophthalmos, which is seen only in Graves' disease. Exophthalmos actually isn't due to high T3 and T4, but is instead due to the autoimmune effect of antithyroid antibodies cross-reacting with the retroorbital tissue. Finally, on the neurologic exam, test for hyperreflexia and signs of distal neuropathy. So, if you suspect hyperthyroidism, the first lab tests to order are serum TSH, T3, and T4. Importantly, TSH is the most sensitive test for hyperthyroidism and is usually able to diagnose subclinical disease as well. Patients with primary hyperthyroidism will usually have depressed TSH and elevated T3 and T4. But the reason serum TSH isn't perfectly specific is because in the less common cases of secondary hypothyroidism, where the level of TSH is the problem in the first place, well, in those cases, you'll also see decreased TSH levels. So once the diagnosis of primary hyperthyroidism is established using lab testing, the radioactive iodine uptake test, or RAIU, can help differentiate the different types of hyperthyroidism. I explain this in more detail in the audio brick called Thyroid Diagnosis, Putting It All Together, but the RAIU looks and works a bit like a PET scan, where you can visualize the accumulation of an injected radioactive tracer in the thyroid as varying shades of gray to black on a white background. In a normal thyroid, the tracer should accumulate diffusely in the thyroid, and the RAIU scan will show what appears to be a grainy gray image of a thyroid. By capturing the tracer uptake at a specific amount of elapsed time after injection of the tracer into the bloodstream, it's possible to quantify the amount of thyroid activity by how dark gray the tracer accumulation appears on the scan. The darker the thyroid, the more active it is. In diseases like Graves' disease, where the gland is homogeneously oversynthesizing thyroid hormone, the thyroid will appear uniformly much darker gray, or even black. A toxic multinodular goiter, in contrast, will show patchy increases in tracer uptake. Thyroid adenomas will appear distinctly as singular dark gray or black spots on the gray thyroid, where they're sometimes referred to as hot nodules. But you may also notice a nodule on physical exam that doesn't show increased radioiodine uptake on RAIU, and that's an indication for biopsy. Reason is, these cold nodules are the ones most likely to represent malignancy. In addition to the RAIU, TSH receptor-stimulating immunoglobulins in the blood will be positive in Graves' disease and are sensitive and specific enough to make this test an acceptable alternative to the RAIU, especially if there's patient concern for radiation exposure. Unfortunately, it's not useful in identifying any of the other thyroid pathologies. Pop quiz time, gang. What diagnostic tests establish the diagnosis of primary hyperthyroidism? Decreased serum TSH is most sensitive for primary hyperthyroidism, and elevated T3 and T4 confirm the diagnosis, though these may be normal in subclinical hyperthyroidism. Part 5. How do we treat hyperthyroidism? Treatment of hyperthyroidism comes in three phases. Initial relief of symptoms, normalization of hormone levels with medication, then curative treatment with radiation or surgery. Symptom relief involves blunting the sympathetic surge of hyperthyroidism using beta blockers. Drugs like propranolol or metoprolol are commonly administered for prompt symptom control, lowering heart rate and calming the patient. In addition, they help prevent some of the most serious consequences of hyperthyroidism, like dangerous tachyarrhythmias. And they're the first-line therapy prior to definitive treatment. After beta blockers, the next step is to reduce levels of thyroid hormone synthesis using the thioamide antithyroid drugs methimazole and propylthiouracil, also known as PTU. Both work by inhibiting the incorporation of iodide into thyroid hormone precursors. They're used for both long-term treatment and for the pre-treatment of high-risk older and cardiac patients prior to definitive curative treatment. Now, methimazole is the preferred thioamide antithyroid agent because it has several pharmacokinetic advantages over the alternative drug PTU, including greater efficacy, longer half-life, higher concentration in the thyroid, and fewer adverse effects. Now, you may be wondering, why use PTU at all? Well, it turns out it's not totally useless. You see, methimazole is teratogenic in the first trimester of pregnancy, so PTU is definitely preferred in this context. Also, some patients are just not responsive to methimazole, and PTU may be more effective based on their specific metabolism. And, as I'll describe in a moment, PTU is the preferred drug in the life-threatening thyroid storm for certain pharmacologic properties that methimazole just doesn't have. The antithyroid drugs have a few uncommon but serious side effects that you should be familiar with. They can cause agranulocytosis, leading to a weakened immune system. They can cause liver damage, as well as an oncopositive vasculitis resulting in fever, arthralgias, uveitis, purpuric skin lesions, glomerular injury, and hemoptysis. If the patient exhibits any of the following, the drug should be discontinued. Now on to the final curative phase of treatment. In most cases, the preferred approach is radioiodine ablation of the thyroid gland. Radioiodine ablation involves administration of a radioactive isotope of sodium iodide by mouth, after which it's rapidly incorporated into the thyroid gland. The radioactive decay of the iodide isotope damages local thyroid tissue, and over several weeks, thyroid function is reduced as the gland is destroyed. Radioiodine treatment is often used instead of antithyroid drugs for patients older than 60 years or who have comorbidities that make the symptoms of hyperthyroidism particularly dangerous. It's also used in patients who are still symptomatic after taking antithyroid medications. Note that antithyroid drugs are still given in the days leading up to the procedure to avoid transient hyperthyroidism due to an acute release of thyroid hormones during irradiation. Radiation is contraindicated in children or pregnant women because of the potential adverse effects of radiation on growth and on the fetus, including growth retardation, impaired brain function, and cancer. These patients can be treated with either antithyroid drugs or surgery. But in most cases, though, radioablation is well tolerated, and the most important side effect is hypothyroidism. Duh, that's why they need thyroid hormone replacement afterwards. Now, the main alternative to radioablation is surgical removal of the thyroid. Thyroidectomy is the most definitive treatment of hyperthyroidism and describes a range of procedures from partial removal in the case of isolated nodules to total thyroidectomy in the case of Graves' disease or a diffusely multinodular goiter. While it makes up less than 1% of the initial management of hyperthyroidism, thyroidectomy is the treatment of choice for patients who have had major adverse effects or treatment failure with antithyroid drugs and those who can't take radioactive iodine, like children and pregnant women. Surgical removal is also preferred when large goiters compress structures in the neck, like the larynx or pharynx. However, thyroidectomy can be complicated by accidental removal of the adjacent parathyroid glands, leading to hypoparathyroidism and resultant hypocalcemia. Another important complication, though less frequent, is injury to the superior laryngeal or recurrent laryngeal nerves. Pop quiz time, friends. What is the most common complication of thyroidectomy? The answer is hypoparathyroidism from accidental removal of the parathyroid glands. Now, it's important to set patient expectations for treatment. Neither the antithyroid medications nor the definitive curative therapies will affect Graves' ophthalmopathy, since that happens by a totally different mechanism than elevation in thyroid hormone. All right, now to the part most relevant to my specialty of emergency medicine. How do you treat the really bad news bears situation, thyroid storm? These patients are at risk of cardiovascular collapse due to arrhythmias and heart failure, and frequently have complications of the central nervous system and other organs. Management entails several steps, often done in rapid sequence. First, basic resuscitation measures are taken to ensure a patent airway, which may be compromised in a comatose or seizing patient and complicated by a goiter. Adequate oxygenation and ventilation must be ensured, which may be compromised if the patient goes into pulmonary edema from high-output heart failure. And in particular, circulation must be closely monitored with arrhythmias treated and fluid replacement administered if the patient needs it. Once those measures are taken, the beta blocker propranolol and the antithyroid medication PTU are administered as in regular thyrotoxic patients. In this case, propranolol and PTU are preferred over other medications in their respective classes due to their ability to not only prevent the synthesis of new thyroid hormone, but also to inhibit conversion of T4 to the more bioactive T3 in the peripheral tissues. Glucocorticoids like methylprednisolone are used to reduce thyroxine synthesis and release, as well as to reduce T4 to T3 conversion. And finally, a potassium iodide solution is given after the antithyroid drugs have had a chance to take effect. It's a bit counterintuitive, but it takes advantage of an autoregulatory quirk called the Wolff-Chaikoff effect, in which follicular cells downregulate the release of thyroid hormones when exposed to iodide excess. All right, let's go over that one more time, just to see if you can bust out that knowledge in an emergency. What are the drugs used in the treatment of thyroid storm? The answer is propranolol, propylthiouracil, or PTU, glucocorticoids, and potassium iodide solution. See? Now you're ready to save a life. And that's a wrap. Let's see how well you remember your hyperthyroidism. First, can you name two major changes in physiology that account for most of the symptoms of hyperthyroidism? The symptoms of hyperthyroidism are caused primarily by increased basal metabolism and potentiation of the sympathetic nervous system. The former can lead to weight loss, increased appetite, increased GI motility, heat intolerance, sweating, and in severe cases, hyperthermia. The latter can lead to tachycardia and in severe cases, tachyarrhythmias and heart failure. They also contribute to some of the neuropsychiatric symptoms found, including tremors, hyperreflexia, insomnia, restlessness, and in severe cases, psychosis and agitated delirium. Second, can you name three diseases that cause hyperthyroidism and identify the most common etiology in the United States? In the United States, the most common disease that leads to hyperthyroidism is Graves' disease. Other causes of primary hyperthyroidism include toxic multinodular goiter, toxic adenoma, thyroiditis, and pregnancy. Ingestion of thyroid hormones can lead to exogenous hyperthyroidism with the same symptoms as the primary disorders. Next, what laboratory findings confirm the diagnosis of hyperthyroidism, and what additional diagnostic testing is most useful for distinguishing between various causes of hyperthyroidism? Primary hyperthyroidism can be diagnosed if a patient has elevated T3 and T4 levels with decreased TSH. While TSH is the most sensitive test for hyperthyroidism and can detect subclinical disease, T3 and T4 allow you to distinguish between primary hyperthyroidism and secondary hypothyroidism. Once you know a patient's hyperthyroid, the radioactive iodine uptake scintigram, or RAIU, helps distinguish between the different causes of hyperthyroidism. Finally, what is the three-step process usually used to treat hyperthyroidism? Hyperthyroidism is first treated with beta blockers, second with antithyroid medications like methimazole and PTU, and third with definitive therapy to either destroy the thyroid with radioablation or remove it surgically. Now, armed with your newfound knowledge, let's get back to that patient from the intro. A 22-year-old female presents to her student health clinic with classic symptoms of thyrotoxicosis. What labs are most important to order for your initial workup, and what results do you suspect? You order a laboratory panel for your patient that includes a TSH, T3, and T4 level. Then, remembering that she hasn't had a menstrual period for 2 months, you order a quantitative beta-HCG. While hyperthyroidism can cause dysmenorrhea, pregnancy in absolute terms is a far more likely culprit. The tests reveal decreased TSH, increased T3 and T4, and an elevated beta-HCG. You're not looking forward to telling your patient that she's both hyperthyroid and pregnant. It's a lot for someone her age to take in. But she listens and absorbs the information, despite being understandably shocked. You prescribe propranolol as the beta blocker for initial symptom relief, and propylthiouracil as the antithyroid medication. Your heart beats a little faster when you think that you almost forgot to order that pregnancy test. Otherwise, she'd be leaving your office with a prescription for the very teratogenic methimazole. It's okay. No harm, no foul, and you'll definitely remember next time. Finally, you give your patient a referral to an OBGYN specializing in high-risk pregnancy. Whether or not she decides to keep the baby, she'll need to see an OBGYN soon. And that's our show. Make sure to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts if you like what you heard. Remember, your feedback helps us improve. You can enjoy the full BRICS experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already. Until next time, friends.